From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game.
Gary Bettman was complaining that the sampling of brains was too small with respect to hockey players. What he was basically saying was that more players need to die.
Derek Bogard was an enforcer in the NHL. He died 4 years ago. Ahead on Only a Game, Bogard's father talks about his son, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and the NHL's new spotter policy aimed at identifying players exhibiting signs of concussion during games. Also ahead, why making money via fantasy sports is just a dream. A 20-something couple in Chicago asks, are we too old to become baseball fans? And a shameless outlaw entrepreneur's plan to profit by putting NCAA President Mark Emmert's likeness on a T-shirt. Stay tuned. An email arrived in the Only a Game inbox this week.
Hey, Bill.
It said,
boy, is my face red. All this time I thought the DraftKings was an online bartending course. Turns out it's a surefire way to make money.
If you own a television or a computer, you have probably seen the ads listener John Fry is talking about. They sound something like this.
Just pick your sport, pick your players, and pick up your cash. That's it. It's the simplest way to win life-changing piles of cash every week.
Joshua Brustein and Ira Boudwe of Bloomberg Business have done the math, and they can tell us exactly when we should expect to see those life-changing piles of cash. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
I probably shouldn't be laughing at this, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on DraftKings, the site we mentioned. There's also a site called FanDuel offering a similar proposition. Here's a short clip from one of their commercials.
I won $15,000 off of a $5 entry.
Winners get immediate cash payouts, and there's no season-long commitment.
Sounds pretty good to me. Ira, what did you find out about these so-called normal, everyday fans walking into bars who've won amazing sums playing fantasy sports?
Well, what we found is that mostly the money eventually flows to the very best players, who are a tiny minority of the total pool. So that, yes, it is quite possible to put in $5 and win 15 grand. It's also quite likely that the people who do that play hundreds of times a day, or that if you do that and keep playing, you will eventually lose that money. That was kind of the nugget of what we found in digging into this a little.
Joshua, these players who play hundreds of times a day and they're using statistical models and spreadsheets and automated systems to generate and manage hundreds and hundreds of entries at a time, what's that like day to day?
It sounds a lot like work. You kind of sit down at your computer. The point isn't to come up with that one perfect lineup that's going to hit for $15,000 or a $5 bet, but to place hundreds of bets and, you know, make your 8% return.
There is a little bit of skill involved. This isn't exactly like walking into the convenience store and buying all the lottery tickets available in the store because you figure you'll come out ahead.
Yeah, that's right. You have to know both the sport pretty well and be very up to date on the latest players and injuries and streaks and so on. But you also have to really know the games themselves, the daily fantasy structures, because a lot of it depends on picking players that not everybody else is picking. So a lot of it is experience with daily fantasy. You know, having done this hundreds and hundreds of times, they hone in on systems that work.
Ira, you guys cite a couple of studies that have shown that most players lose money, but there's a little graphic at the bottom of the DraftKings commercial that reads, and I'm quoting now, the average user's winnings for the last 12 months, $1,263. Are you telling me I can't even believe the fine print?
Well, I mean, an average, if I'm in a room with Bill Gates, that our average wealth is in the billions, but it doesn't tell you very much. So we use data from Roto Grinders, which is a community of 20,000 players. It showed that at least the volume of wins is concentrated among the top 10 players, you know, winning 873 times a day when they play, the top 100 players winning 330 times, the rest of the field of 20,000 winning an average, you know, 13 times. So that doesn't tell you kind of how often they're hitting per how many times they play, but it gives you a sense of how it's concentrated. And Sports Business Journal did a look at 3 months of baseball data and found that only 1.3% of players across that three-month span finished in the green.
So it's the same old story. The 1% wins.
Exactly.
Josh, remind me again, why is this not considered gambling?
So when the federal laws on sports gambling were written, there was an explicit carve-out for fantasy sports. It was really just making sure that if you're in a rotisserie baseball league and everyone puts in, you know, $50 or $100, and at the end the winner takes the pot, that that wasn't going to be seen as the same thing as, you know, a Las Vegas sports book or, you know, or the online alternative. And so what happened was these games were developed, you know, largely with those laws in mind.
Ira, I just have one more question. You guys have done your homework, obviously, on this. What are you doing talking to me? Why aren't you at your computer winning $15,000 for every five?
I think I would be very bad at it. I play season-long fantasy and do a mediocre at that. But this is actually, I think, you look at the people who do it, they frequently come out of sort of consulting, or one of the guys I talked to is a very good player, is a certified public accountant. It really pulls for that kind of highly organized, highly systematic thinking that is actually maybe not my strongest suit. But I don't think I'd be one of those sharks.
So it's not the guys who have the baseball caps turned backwards sitting in the brightly lit bars cheering as they watch TV?
Doesn't seem that way.
You can link to Joshua Brustein and Ira Broadway's article, "You Aren't Good Enough to Win Money Playing Daily Fantasy Football," at onlyagame.org. Joshua and Ira, thank you very much. This has been fun. I appreciate your joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's easy for fans to assume that pro athletes lead glorious lives right up until it becomes apparent that some of them don't. We'll lead off our discussion of three stories you should know with a reminder of one such story. Joining me this week are USA Today columnist Nancy Armour and sports journalist Eric Malinowski. Welcome back to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric, we're going to begin with you. Go ahead with your story, please.
Thanks, Bill. There was a wonderful profile this week from Lindsay Adler at BuzzFeed. She went back to the University of Texas at Austin to go to class with former NFL running back Ricky Williams, who is studying for his PhD in psychology. Now, Williams had a respectable 11-year professional career, but so much of his promise was derailed by his social anxiety disorder. Now, he entered the NFL in 1999, and the profile got me thinking about how far it is that we've come since then regarding sports and the stigma of social anxiety. One notable example is Zach Greinke of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who's talked about his own struggles for about a decade, and he's in the midst of a historic season right now. But at the same time, I couldn't name you five more baseball players who've been even a fraction as open about it as Greinke has. So I feel like there's still much more that we can do in terms of awareness, but we've certainly reached some point where careers need not be derailed as a result of it. And I guess reading the piece just kind of made me wish that we'd had this level of openness when Williams was a 22-year-old rookie back in New Orleans and not a 38-year-old doctoral student in Austin.
Nancy, is this stigmatization of athletes with emotional problems or mental issues something that you've encountered in your work?
Well, it's ironic that, Eric, you bring the story up this week, because this is also the week that Susie Faber-Hamilton is coming out with her book, and completely different scenario, but also tied to mental health issues. You know, there is still the stigma. They have spent their entire lives training to be the best, to be perfect. It is great to see people like Ricky Williams and others speaking out about it. That lets other people, whether they're athletes or not, know that, you know what, it's okay. This is not a flaw. This is part of who you are.
Probably fair to point out, Eric, that Ricky Williams has a long way to go. He's only an undergraduate now, and his PhD is a dream. But more power to him. I hope it works out. We spoke recently with Landon Donovan, and he very casually mentioned that he'd had a lot of therapy in order to get through some of the issues that he found he faced when he was going through his soccer career.
Yeah, and, you know, Landon has been very open. He's another great example, very open about struggling with things and meditating, taking time off. We can all learn from it. And the more we talk about it, the more people realize it's not a flaw.
Football coaches were in the news urging and even requiring their players to get more sleep, which is ironic because coaches never sleep. And if they do, they sleep in their offices on a couch so they can watch more film. It's time, I think, to challenge that mystique that says you can't be a great football coach unless you never go home for dinner and don't remember the names of your children. It's ridiculous. They ought to be able to do what they do in a more efficient way. And if they did, maybe we wouldn't have to pay them $5.5 million a year to do what they do. They're not brain surgeons. And brain surgeons get to go home for dinner. And this is my topic, and I'm ready to hear what you think about it, Nancy.
I agree with you 100%. Every time I've heard this, you know, a coach saying, oh, yeah, I was at the office until 4 in the morning. Why? What are you doing at 2 a.m. that you couldn't have been doing at 4 p.m. or even at 7 p.m.? I mean, come on. You're coaching football or basketball or whatever you're coaching. Like you said, it's not brain surgery. It's not rocket science.
Eric?
Yeah, you know, Nancy brought up, you know, the idea of coaches, you know, being in the office until 4 a.m. It seems like there's two kinds, the ones that are either in the office until 4 a.m. or the ones that get up at 4 a.m. You know, there was a very, very well-written profile of John Gruden in The New Yorker back in 2011. And keep in mind, this is after, you know, he was coaching. He's an analyst for ESPN at this point. Mm-hmm. But he would still get up every day at 3:17 in the morning just because that was an arbitrary alarm clock setting that he just never bothered to change. But, you know, this is something that has been perpetuated throughout the years, and it's kind of nice to see it kind of thawing a little bit.
Okay, Nancy, I understand that you have been keeping track of high school football in Texas, where some of the players have taken the law into their own hands.
Yeah, we've actually had two incidents in a span of about 8 days in San Antonio. They're both in San Antonio. I'm not sure what's going on there. But in the first, two players basically blindsided a referee. Mm-hmm. And then about 8 days later, another player tackled a ref. The two players in the first incident said that they were told by their assistant coach to take out the ref. But either way, this is a really dangerous thing that we're seeing. And I hope that it's not going to be the start of a trend. Hopefully the reaction to it will let kids know that, yeah, no, this is not acceptable in any way, shape, or form.
I simply just find it incredible that with so much more focus being on youth football players today, and the idea that the coaches or coach or whoever would have the idea that they could order this hit, basically, and not have it come back around again is just kind of remarkable to me and just completely naive.
I share your feeling that it's dangerous, obviously, and it is deplorable without any question. I wonder, however, whether this is one of those things that we didn't hear very much about. It's always been going on to some small extent, but it hasn't always been filmed.
Well, it's interesting. One of my colleagues, Eric Brady, did a story earlier this week on this whole phenomenon. And one of the things that I found fascinating was a national organization of officials. It's always had insurance, but they now have assault insurance. The fact that they thought that this was a good thing to have, yeah, maybe it is going on more than we've thought. You hear an incident or two every couple months, it seems like. But yeah, if they feel that there's a need to insure against it, that's really troubling.
My guest for Three Stories You Should Know have been USA Today columnist Nancy Armour and sports journalist Eric Malinowski. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
The start of the NHL regular season is still 2.5 weeks away, but the league made news this week with its spotter policy. Under this plan, non-medical personnel will be watching to see if a player might have suffered a concussion, at which point the spotter can politely ask the team's medical staff to stop the game. Joining me is Len Bogard, whose son, former NHL player Derek Bogard, died of a prescription drug overdose 4 years ago after suffering numerous concussions during his 6-year NHL career. Mr. Bogard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
I know that you no longer follow the day-to-day NHL news, but is it any comfort at all to know that starting on October 7th, spotters with no medical training will be watching out for player safety?
No, not in the least. I think this is just along the same lines as the team doctors. The duty of the doctors is the health and the safety of the players. But, you know, that's in conflict with what the owners want. You know, the owner's priority is money and having a winning team. So the doctors are under tremendous pressure, you know, to get the players back into the game as quickly as possible. This leads to, you know, what happened to my son, over-prescribing of pain medication, you know, which ultimately led to Derek's death.
Prescription drugs were certainly very much involved in the death of your son. Was chronic traumatic encephalopathy a factor in his death as well?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was just the repeated blows to the head with the fights that Derek was engaged in. But this started, you know, back when he was with the Prince George Cougars of the Western Hockey League. They got him a boxing coach while he was there. So while he was with the Cougars for 4 years, you know, he was getting boxing lessons. You know, in 2001, Derek was drafted by the Minnesota Wild, and the Minnesota Wild hired a boxing coach for him, a guy named Scott Ledoux. Scott Ledoux died shortly after Derek. I think if you go to the Concussion Legacy Foundation website, you know, there's Scott Ledoux as being a donor.
His brain was examined as well.
Yes. Yeah. You know, in 2011, Derek was in rehab, and the substance abuse doctors set him up with a boxing clinic. You know, the NHL talks about concussions, and they're trying to do this and they're trying to do that. But, you know, you look at the Minnesota Wild, and then you look at, you know, even the program doctors and the substance abuse, you know, making arrangements for Derek to get boxing lessons. Mm-hmm. So he was subjected to that repetitive trauma.
The NHL has made some changes recently to the game. They've cracked down on headhunting and, to a lesser extent, I suppose, on fighting. Are you happy to see those changes?
Well, that's another thing that, you know, they have supposedly a concussion protocol in place. But, you know, just as recently as during the playoffs in 2014, there was a player by the name of Dale Weiss with the Montreal Canadiens. You know, he took a vicious hit to the head, and it was readily apparent to everybody in the stadium, as well as watching on TV, that, you know, that Weiss was unsteady, he was woozy, he was disorientated. He spent a couple of minutes in the so-called quiet room, and then he was back playing.
NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman told reporters this spring that there is, and I'm quoting now, no evidence that concussion necessarily leads to progressive degenerative brain damage known as chronic traumatic encephalopathy. I'm curious about how you feel about the commissioner's position.
Well, this is just typical. The NHL, they've just taken a page out of the tobacco industry playbook. You know, back in the 1950s, there was a concern over the dangers of smoking, and the industry simply manufactured uncertainty or doubt. You know, they acknowledge, yeah, okay, yes, their smokers have a higher incidence of lung cancer, but why? Said they didn't have sufficient data, you know, the science wasn't there. And Bettman's done exactly the same thing. John Branch, you know, in December of 2011, he had an interview with Gary Bettman. You know, Bettman was complaining that the sampling of brains was too small with respect to hockey players. What he was basically saying was that more players need to die.
Given how much attention has been given to the National Football League's concussion problem and the lawsuits, of course, brought by thousands of players against the league, do you think the media has gone too light on the National Hockey League?
Yeah, they have. But I think there's some rationale for it. Like you said, there's thousands of you know, players that have come forward in the NFL, whereas in the NHL, you know, there's, what, 80, 90, maybe 100 players that have come forward. That all has to do with the NHL being a small, incestuous community. You know, these players, as they're growing up, they leave home when they're 15, 16 years of age. They go and play in the, you know, the Western Hockey League, the Ontario Hockey League, and they're being paid, you know, $30, $40 a week. Everything is done for them. And if they make it to the NHL, you know, everything is basically handed to them on a platter. Mm. But once their career is over, they have nothing. They look to stay in hockey. So they're looking to coach or to scout or, you know, in some capacity to stay within a game of hockey. And once they're there, they don't want to jeopardize, you know, their jobs.
Your family has sued the NHL in connection with your son's death. Can you comment on where that lawsuit stands?
The NHL is, what they've done is they've taken a page out of the NFL. They're using this preemptive clause, basically saying that Derek was part of a union, and as a member of a union, you can't sue your employer. So that's what the status is right now.
It must be extremely difficult for you to encounter what the commissioner is saying about no connection proved between concussions and apparent brain damage later on.
It's about money. That's the bottom line. You know, especially the fighting aspect of it, it's simply entertainment, and it brings in fans. You know, the NHL has said, you know, there's only two times that during the course of the game when, you know, fans get to their feet, and one is if their team scores a goal or if there's a fight on the ice. I know from, you know, going to Minnesota and watching Derek play, And I'd be sitting in the crowd and, you know, I'd be looking around at the fans and they were disengaged from the game. You know, they'd be sitting there talking to each other or, you know, on their cell phones. But then as soon as Derek hit the ice, you know, everybody started nudging each other saying, well, you know, the boogeyman's on the ice, the boogeyman's on the ice. And everybody would gravitate to the front of their seats in anticipation of waiting, you know, for something to happen, which inevitably it did.
And that something was a fight.
Or a hit, him trying to ram somebody through the boards. But you could see it was just entertainment.
Len Bogard is the father of former NHL player Derek Bogard. Mr. Bogard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Lots of sports fans, perhaps most of them, are born into an allegiance based on family or geography or both. In our next story, independent producer Jake Smith, who lacked that experience, explores the possibility of intentionally becoming a fan of one of his local baseball teams.
I'm at a sports bar talking to Marianne, the bartender, and she's pretty skeptical when I tell her that I'm trying to become a baseball fan.
How old are you now?
23.
If you're not into baseball, you ain't going to get into baseball now.
Yeah.
Because it's boring. It's like watching golf.
This place, the internet tells me, is maybe the best White Sox bar in Chicago. I assumed that meant drunks screaming at a TV. Not the case. A half dozen fans watch the Sox game on this sleepy Saturday in June, and I've come to watch them, to see what it might mean to be part of this tribe. My girlfriend Susie and I live here in Chicago, though we've never paid much attention to the Bulls or the Bears or anyone. Until this spring, when our friends went nuts watching the Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. It was hard not to feel like we were missing something, and this would be the summer we tried to find it. Why baseball? Well, because I like hot dogs, and Susie wanted a baseball hat.
I was like, maybe I'll get a Cubs hat, because I'm a Cubs fan, and then I realized, no, I'm not.
Susie's family says they like the Cubs, but they rarely watch the games. And I went to college near where their rivals, the White Sox, play. So, just for fun, we engineered a little rivalry. Sox fan me versus Cubs fan her. At least, that's what we aspired to be. What we were was two people who'd rather see a Broadway show than watch the World Series. Was it just too late for us, as Marianne suggested? And even if we managed to get into our teams, would we... could we ever experience a real rivalry? In a couple months, the two Chicago teams were going to face each other in a series of games known as the Crosstown Classic. We would have tickets to the ballpark that weekend, we decided, and we'd find out whether team loyalty can really be a conscious choice.
I graduated high school in 1969, and that's when the Cubs were good.
Marianne, the bartender, works at a White Sox bar, but she herself is a Cubs fan. Back in high school, she'd go to games with her friends and fawn over the players.
I mean, they had Randy Huntley, Billy Williams, Ernie Banks, Selma. He used to go in by the bleachers and get the bleacher bum screaming.
Pretty much every real fan I talk to has a story like this. But Susie and I have not had those formative experiences. We need another way in. We describe this dilemma to Chris, a Cubs fan we meet at a bar across the street from Wrigley Field. His solution?
As soon as you pass through the walls of Wrigley Field, you are overcome by the magic of baseball. If that doesn't make you a baseball fan or a Cub fan or any fan of summer, then there's no point in talking to you right now.
Susie herself is convinced. We need to go to a game at Wrigley. But before then, we have some work to do. For two so-called fans, Susie and I don't know much about our teams or baseball. So when we realize that the Sox and the Cubs are already playing the first installment of the Crosstown Classic, we make it a point to watch the game in a nearby bar.
Loser makes the winner dinner.
As we watch, we Google the gibberish acronyms that appear on the TV screen.
An RBI is a run batted in.
Susie starts to recognize the Cubs players. She takes a liking to Chris Bryant, the talented and handsome third baseman.
Ooh, Chris Bryant. One for two.
The Sox lose, meaning I'm making tacos. But for the first time, we've both found ourselves getting into the game. It's fun. It feels like this whole fan thing might be within our reach. 2 weeks later, we finally get to a Cubs game. As we walk into Wrigley to find our seats, Susie is beaming.
It's beautiful. See the history.
She spent the day watching YouTube videos about Chris Bryant.
His nickname is The Silk.
We settle in with some beers and brats. It's a perfect summer night. Warm, breezy, not a cloud in the sky. It's a heck of a game with the Cubs and Colorado Rockies both racking up runs. Suddenly, it's the bottom of the ninth.
Come on, Chris. Oh, this is my guy.
The Cubs are down by one. Chris Bryant steps up to the plate and... He hits a homer, and the Cubs win by one.
Go, Cubs, go!
A change has come over Susie. Over the course of a few hours, she's become a Cubs fan for life. In those same few hours, Chris Bryant has single-handedly undermined our relationship. Just kidding. But as we head home, even I, the longtime sports cynic, have to admit, that was incredible. It's hard not to get caught up in the thrill of a dramatic win at home. But at the same time, I wonder if I should resent the Cubs for winning. Because I don't. And maybe that makes me less of a Sox fan. The weeks pass, and before we know it, Susie and I are heading down to the Cell, home of the White Sox, for the Crosstown Classic. Our final showdown. We find our seats looking across a rowdy sea of red, white, blue, and black.
Let's go, White Sox!
We are reveling in our rivalry, and all is good until the ninth inning. The Sox are down by one, and a row of Cubs fans behind us starts talking smack. Look at the scoreboard, they yell at a nearby group of Sox fans. The Sox fans shout back something nasty. It quickly escalates. This is the kind of macho nonsense that's always turned me off of sports. I shake my head as three security guards come over and threaten to kick out the belligerent Cubs fans. Things calm down just in time to watch Avi Garcia hit a pop fly for the third out. White Sox lose. After the game, Susie and I sit in the stands talking.
The question was, can we become fans? I definitely feel like a fan.
I feel like I couldn't get into it this time because there was so much kind of negativity. Kind of ruined it for me.
A few weeks later, I get an email promising me free White Sox tickets if I fill out a survey. The first question... On a scale of 1 to 5, how much of a White Sox fan are you? Yeah, Susie and I enjoy watching baseball now. And yes, I'll keep rooting for the White Sox. But does that really make me part of the club? After all, I'm never going to throw a punch to defend my team. And all my life, it's felt like that's the kind of thing that rivalries are built on. But there's more to it than that. If Marianne can work at a White Sox bar and never doubt her dedication to the Cubs, then maybe I don't have to throw a fit when the Cubs win, or even when my girlfriend fawns over Chris Bryant. I check box number 3 on the survey. Average White Sox fan. For Only a Game, I'm Jake Smith in Chicago.
In last week's program, I spoke with Lisa Murray, formerly a cheerleader with the Golden State Warriors. Ms. Murray is currently working to ensure that NBA and NFL clubs pay their cheerleaders at least minimum wage. The responses to that conversation, which appeared on our website, ranged from ridicule to outrage. Fernando Diago wrote, "What about looking for a better paying and more productive job? Those cheerleaders suffer from narcissistic personality disorder, which is a mental disorder in which people have an inflated sense of their own importance." Another commenter, JJMA, doesn't see it that way. He or she cited the experience of a family member who is currently a cheerleader for an NFL team and figured out the young woman is currently being paid about $1.20 an hour. Part of the comment reads, "Being taken advantage of? Yes, absolutely. And the NFL should be ashamed of itself. However, recent history shows that's not going to happen, ever." I also spoke last week with Gilbert Gall, the author of Billion Dollar Ball, which examines the economics of college football. Professor Gall compares the palatial athletic facilities at Penn State to the ancient and humble quarters of the Honors College there. On our Facebook page, Sam Collin wrote, "Honors College should get a better TV deal or find a donor willing to fund a new building," being somewhat sarcastic. I'm glad he added that note about how we should take his response. The sound and fury surrounding the booming business of fantasy sports operations like DraftKings preceded our consideration of it on this week's show and led Richard C. to post the following note on our website shortly after the NFL season began. If a racetrack plastered the airwaves like these companies, politicians coast to coast would be having hissy fits on the evils of wagering made easy. It must be fabulous to have the Beltway lobbyists who work for the NFL, NBA, NHL, and MLB placing smiley faces on betting pools. You can comment on what you hear on Only a Game at onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagamenpr. Coming up on Only a Game, a former college athlete attempts to profit the NCAA way by putting the image of a recognizable sports figure on a T-shirt. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill, and welcome to our new listeners at WKGC in Panama City, Florida, otherwise known as GC90.7, the voice of Gulf Coast State College.
What have you done with Charlie?
I'm here with some stacks of wax to make your groovin' behoovin'.
This week, Rutgers head football coach Kyle Flood was suspended for 3 games and fined $50,000 for contacting a professor about the academic status of former Rutgers cornerback Nadir Barnwell. A big no-no. You can't be doing that. Barnwell and 5 other players had been cut from the team for offenses ranging from home invasion to domestic violence to assault. They're really cleaning things up down there in New Brunswick, aren't they?
That's not much of a range, Bill. I mean, that's pretty much the same crime in different contexts. Rutgers is trying to become a major power in college football fast, and there's only one way to do it, and that's pretty much to risk embarrassment. And this is pretty much what they have.
It is not news, of course, for an NFL team to cut a player. They do that all the time. But after cutting kicker Kai Forbath, the team in Washington, D.C. held an open tryout for season ticket holders, and then they settled on a guy who had a little bit more experience than the average season ticket holder, right?
Yeah. They hired this guy named Dustin Hopkins, who not long ago was practicing his kicking in a public park with his wife serving as the holder. I would be very impressed if they signed his wife, too.
He's got to have a holder.
Exactly right.
All right, Charlie, I'm going to read you a headline from the Washington Post now, and then I'm going to get out of the way. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. Packers fans eat 120-yard bratwurst named Jay Cutler.
No, actually, it's an actual bratwurst, and it ran the length of Lambeau Field, and it was nicknamed after Jay Cutler because, quote, here it comes, wait for it, he's used to getting smoked by the Packers.
You have before you a weighty document which purports to rate the best sports cities in the U.S. for spectators. Any qualms about number one on the list?
No, Boston is number one, believe it or not, ranked 9th in football, which I think is high because there is no football in Boston. All due respect to the Boston College Eagles, there's no football in Boston except the Patriots. And I think if you're going to rank places in football, you've got to have something to do with college and something to do with high school. Dallas is ranked only 2 notches above Boston for football, which is absurd.
All right. Did you bring your Mr. NASCAR hat with you today?
Let me see.
Okay,
yes, I did.
Good. The 2015 Chase for the Cup begins this weekend at Chicagoland Speedway. Who has the kind of setup that will carry them to NASCAR glory? And what did I just say?
Well, Bill, I think you got to go with Jimmy
Johnson. You're doing it again with the voice.
I think Kyle Busch is going to win it this year, and I don't know why. I just have that feeling.
Okay, take off your hat.
Okay.
Charlie, Moses Malone died on Sunday. The Basketball Hall of Famer's impact on the game was, of course, considerable from a very early age. Have you a Moses Malone story to share?
Moses Malone was the hardest-working basketball player I ever saw. He's very close to being the most hardest-working athlete I ever saw. He never took a minute off. We lost Daryl Dawkins earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tall people generally can have heart problems, and it's apparently what happened to him.
According to a recent Sports Business Daily report, WNBA attendance dropped 3% overall in 2015. League games averaged 7,318 fans, the lowest in league history. This has gotten the attention of NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, who said this week that the league, quote, thought it would have broken through by now. Why hasn't it?
It's an indoor league that takes place in the summer. It's very much a niche sport still. They had 33 sellouts, which was 25 more than they had last year. I mean, I don't know what Adam Silver would qualify as a quote-unquote breakthrough. They have a TV contract. They have tremendous advertising. The fans who like it really like it. And as I said, they had 33 sellouts this year, which is 25 more than they had last year. I don't know what would qualify as a breakthrough.
Canadiens defenseman P.K. Subban was in the news this week. He donated $10 million to the Montreal Children's Hospital Foundation, which is going to establish a fund to assist families to help pay for medical care. He is seen, of course, as an on-ice villain in numbers of NHL cities. Maybe henceforth he'll be celebrated, even in places like Boston and Toronto.
$10 million will get your attention, and $10 million will make a lot of children well. And P.K. Subban should at least get a hand the first time he steps on the ice in every game this year. Then you can go back to booing him again.
When you look at the Sugarland Skeeters lineup card...
Don't spoil the surprise, because you know I do it regularly. Look at the Sugarland Skeeters lineup card. Go ahead, because we have to finish the show.
In any case, you will see not one, but two Palmeiros. Why is that?
Because Rafael is signed with the Skeeters of the Independent Atlantic League, and he's going to play alongside Patrick for the remainder of the season. He did not leave baseball under the greatest of circumstances.
No, he
absolutely did not do any performance-enhancing drugs, except for the ones he did,
right.
And that's the last anybody remembers of him. But now he's going to play with his son in an independent league, and good for him.
Baseball teams, of course, sometimes give out baseball cards for promotional reasons. So, he said, setting up the joke, why was it such a big deal when the Philadelphia Phillies did that at Wednesday's game?
They have a new rookie card, and it's a rookie card for the Pope. Pope Francis, as part of his American tour, is going to be visiting Philadelphia. And the Phillies, you know, have put together a very handsome-looking rookie card for the Pope.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know why, if the Pope is so well-connected to, you know, the deity, that he would wind up playing for the Phillies and not, for example, for the Cardinals. But that's the way it goes.
I'm just grateful the Phillies weren't doing bobblehead night that night.
Don't give them any ideas.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
76-0. That was the final score of the Howard football team's loss at Boston College last weekend. Howard wasn't the only team from the FCS, Division I football's lower tier, to lose to an opponent from the upper tier FBS. Tennessee Martin lost to Ole Miss 76-3, and Alcorn State fell to Georgia Tech 69-6. College football fans probably know that elite teams often open their seasons against weaker opponents, but what they might not know is that when that happens, money changes hands. Lots of it. David Blackburn is the athletic director at Chattanooga. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill. And by the way, I was at University of Tennessee for 22 years, so I was on the FBS side until 2 years ago. So I get close sides.
We're going to get to that. But first of all, tell me, what is a guarantee game?
Typically what it means is that you contract with a school and they guarantee you a certain amount of money to make that game, you know, occur.
Chattanooga has visited at least one opponent from college football's upper tier each year since 2001. Your department gets $500,000 for a game at Florida State this year, another $500,000 for a game at Alabama next year. How important are those matchups to your department's financial health?
Great question. They're very important because that's a lot of money, you know, for our budget. Our budget is right at $16 million. It's not so crucial that it's life-threatening, but it certainly helps us out. The big schools look at it as a chance to get a, you know, win that might help catapult them into a bowl game. If you hit six wins and you are of a Power 5 league, for example, you're going to get a bowl bid. So it's sexy for them in that regard. So it's a win-win, really, for both sides, I think. And our kids look forward to playing that, you know, that competition. And every now and again, we compete.
Where does the money from these games go? These $500,000 checks, does that all go right back into the football program, or are you supporting other sports on campus?
We disperse it among the department, but we try to make sure that football gets a huge portion of that because they're the ones having to earn that.
Mm-hmm.
So most of it goes back to football, but a lot of it goes toward general operating, which at our level helps.
Is there ever any worry that fans who have paid for tickets to see these games are going to say, oh, man, I don't want to see these guys play Alabama. This is just going to be a slaughter.
It's actually the opposite. Our student-athletes look forward to it because it's a stage that they know they're going to be on the SEC Network or Big Ten Network. The fans like seeing the high-powered opponent. Whether they match up or not is somewhat irrelevant. It becomes a fun event for us. That's a good thing. we recruit to that. We tell them they're going to get to play against, you know, some really, really good teams. And it helps us morale, recruiting, and certainly financial.
All right. Now, just in my final question, I want to get down to something very specific. Chattanooga visits ninth-ranked Florida State in November. Can you help me out with this? I mean, for fun purposes only, of course, there'd be no betting involved. But how do you like Chattanooga's chances?
Well, that's a great question. I think more people are asking how dumb is the athletic director at Chattanooga, which would be me, because we've got them in 15, we've got Alabama in 16, we've got LSU in 17. And then we've got Kentucky in 18. But the truth is we can drive to those games and save money, and they treat us so well. When we come to these places, they compete hard, but they do treat us with great respect, and we appreciate that.
David Blackburn is the athletic director at Chattanooga. David, thank you very much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
For about four decades, I've been following the story of how the NCAA has grown into a nearly $1 billion a year business while at the same time prohibiting athletes from profiting off their own likenesses. Caleb Presley has been following that story too, though for significantly less time than I have. He's the 22-year-old former backup quarterback for the University of North Carolina, and he's now got his own line of 16 football-related T-shirts. My favorite features NCAA President Mark Emmert standing in front of two tall piles of money, which is what Caleb Presley hopes to earn in profits, $12.50 at a time, selling that T-shirt. Caleb, welcome to Only a Game.
It's good to be here. It's only a game.
Why did you decide to make a T-shirt of NCAA President Mark Emmert?
Well, you know, I just graduated college in May, and while I was in college, my entire 4 years, I was affiliated or I was even a member of the NCAA institution. So Mark Emmert, you know, he's a president of that governing body.
Mm-hmm.
He was always a role model to me. When I graduated, you go through a stage in your life where you're like, what's next? What am I going to do? These are the times you have to look to your mentors, to your role models. I looked up to mine. I said, what would Mark Emmert do right now? I said, you know what? What he would probably do is find some people or find one person and then take their image and their ability and skill and just make as much money as possible off them and not give it to them.
I get it.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm just
out here trying to follow in his footsteps. Now, have I started, you know, a nonprofit tax-exempt organization and am I making $1 million or more an annual salary yet? No, I'm not. You know, but I'm still following in his footsteps. Hopefully, I'll be there one day.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, 15 of the shirts in your line feature the likenesses of current players. It looks like I can choose between Mississippi State quarterback Dak Prescott and Vanderbilt running back Ralph Webb. Have I got that about right?
No, you're completely incorrect. Those are just kind of like artistic abstractions of college athletes. It's really, to put a name on it like that, I wouldn't go that far. I don't know. The art, it's hard to describe. You either get it or you don't. But the thing with those shirts, though, is they also make $12.50 in profit, every single one of them. They're $25 on Barstool. I'm saving all of that money as well, except to the savings account. Mark Emmert, to the checking account. I will save all of that money, and then, you know, in 1 year, 2 years, three, even maybe four, whenever the time is appropriate, I'm going to go back and I'm going to donate that money. I'm trying to be a more charitable person. So whenever the appropriate time comes, I think I'm going to donate that money to 15 different people. Now, I don't know who those 15 people are going to be, but I think over the next 1 to 4 years, hopefully I'll be able to find someone I feel is deserving.
Now, the time frame that you mentioned, this variable time frame, it doesn't have anything to do with when the athletes who might sort of resemble the people on the T-shirts graduate or become ineligible to play football anymore, does it?
Whoa. I mean, I think you're really, you know, I gave you an inch, you took a mile there. That sounds almost outlandish, sounds almost illegal, and sounds about right.
All right. You were a student athlete at the University of North Carolina. At what point during your career there did you realize how much the NCAA and its member schools were profiting off the likenesses of the athletes playing basketball and football? And what did you come to think of that arrangement?
Honestly, the very first day I got on campus, I walked in the student store and they're selling number 2 Carolina blue jerseys for $90. Now, one of my best friends was our quarterback, Bryn Renner. He was also number two. They sold a number two jersey for 3 years straight in the student store. And guess what happened when he graduated? They went to number three. Coincidentally, our best player at the time, Ryan Switzer. You know, they're selling these things for $90 a pop. My friends aren't seeing any of it. That's when I started kind of putting two and two together, realizing that maybe they're making quite a few bucks off of these people, and maybe these people aren't being able to go out to Chipotle with me as often as they should because they're not getting any of the money from these jerseys.
You ran the plan for this entire line of likenesses sort of t-shirts by an attorney, as I understand it. Is he preparing your legal defense as we speak, just in case?
You know, he's not, because the one shirt, which is the Mark Emmert shirt, you know, it's Mark Emmert, and that's how U.S. law goes. You can't represent someone else without either getting their okay or giving them a slice of the profit, what have you. The good thing about Mark Emmert, though, this guy doesn't care, man. He's so for it. He's for the cause. He is 100% about, let's go out, let's find some people who will sell us some stuff, and let's put them on it, and let's act like it's not them, and let's make as much money as we can. Can you imagine my role model trying to sue me? That's not something a mentor would do.
So no cease and desist orders so far, no lawsuits, nobody skulking around looking to serve you so far.
I guess my main point there was, what do you think would happen if Mark Emmert sued me?
I think there would be laughter across the landscape myself.
I think his little NCAA might crumble into from capital to lowercase letters. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense. I'm just trying to say I'm really not that worried about it. If he sues me, honestly, I will be so happy. I've went through life, you know, I had a great childhood. I went to high school. I was able to have a great high school career. I got to go to college and play football. Now I have a cool job. I tour the SEC. Everything's went great so far. However, if Mark Emmert sues me for his likeness, it will by far be the highlight of my entire life. I look forward to the day this happens. Obviously, it will never happen because that would be hypocritical. We all know Mark Emmert, president of the NCAA, is not a hypocrite.
Caleb Presley created the Likeness line of t-shirts. He also works for Barstool.com. Caleb, thanks very much for joining me.
I appreciate it, man. I really do.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Zoe Sobel and Sean Gannon. Our intern is Alex Schroeder, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from T-shirt entrepreneur Caleb Presley, who shares his motto with us, albeit an abbreviated version.
WWMED.
WWMED. What would Morning Edition do? I don't know. I've been trying to figure that out for decades. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.